from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the 1960s in a beautiful Boston suburb named Winchester. Debbie Irving had a nice childhood, and frankly, it was pretty easy. A life of comfort, nice family vacations, all the things a young girl could want. But as she got older, she would look at family photos, and it became more obvious to her. The vacation photos, all white families. The photos of kids playing in large housing developments, all white. She joked that the only diversity she really encountered was the blended white family on the Brady Bunch. But it wasn't until 2009 when Debbie had the moment when everything finally really made sense. And from that point, she began to deeply explore how racial advantage impacted her life and our society. She decided to write a book about that realization, while challenging other white people to consider how their own views are formed. And while she doesn't attempt to speak for all white people, of course not, she certainly has a voice of upper middle class whites that she hopes will echo with others. The book is called Waking Up White. 2 weeks from today, Debbie Irving will be in Rochester for several events related to the subject. But first, she is on the line with us, my guest for the hour on Connections. Debbie Irving, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
And I want to welcome in studio a couple of guests who have made her visit possible. Frank Starpoli is a leadership coach and the organizer of Expanding Events. And Frank, welcome to the program. Why don't you tell us a little bit about why you wanted Debbie Irving to come to Rochester?
Well, Debbie really fit particularly for the group that we're looking to attract, and that is small, medium-sized business leaders, business owners and executives. And Debbie's background is, I think, very relatable. Not only is she a recognized speaker nationally, but she herself has been a leader. She's led organizations. She's served on a number of boards. I think she has a good sense of what it means to make decisions that have to do with mission and with culture. And she also holds an MBA, and she has a passion for helping leaders develop effective and productive workplaces that work for everybody, and that also attract and retain the people that they really want to attract and retain. And she's done a lot of work, obviously, herself on understanding her own attitudes and her own blind spots when it comes to racism. And the last thing I would say about why Debbie is that, and we've talked about this with her, she's coming as a learner herself. She wants to understand better what business leaders are experiencing and what the challenges are, et cetera. So I would say she's a perfect fit for what we want.
And before I ask Reverend Miller about an event Sunday, I believe.
Sunday at 7,
that
yes.
We'll be able to talk about. Frank, I just also want to stress a point here. I have a number of listeners that I could probably name because you get to know a lot of regulars on this program, and we've got tens of thousands of listeners. And over time, people will contact you and say, not another conversation about white guilt. Don't make me apologize for being white. And some people are going to switch this station. I hope they don't. I hope you hang with us this hour and stay here. But what's the message to them, Frank, whether it's this conversation or Debbie's book or the events that you've put together where they say, I don't want to confront that. I don't want to deal with that. I don't want to have to apologize just because I was born white. I know you've heard that.
Oh, yeah.
And so what do you say to that?
I've heard that, but let me maybe give a description of some of the conversations I've had in the last year or so with business leaders. There are some few business leaders, if you have a spectrum, on one end of the spectrum who would say, I don't want to talk about this, I don't want anything to do with it, it's not a real issue, et cetera. There are very few who are like that. Most of the business leaders I've spoken with understand that diversity and inclusion is an asset for their business. And maybe in different ways they've made some attempts to create diversity and inclusion. And those attempts sometimes are very frustrating, especially, for example, trying to find qualified candidates for positions. And qualifications including basic reading, writing, and math skills. So they're frustrated by their attempts to find qualified candidates. And in some cases, they might bring those candidates in and hire them. And then after a while, the candidates leave because they don't feel as if they fit. And so there are the business leaders puzzled. They have goodwill in this, but they're coming to recognize more and more that there are things they don't know and they're not sure about. And I'm finding more and more of them at least saying, I need to understand this better.
Okay.
I'll just quickly describe one business leader in particular, somebody I met with a couple of months ago. He's a former client. And the first thing he said to me when he heard about these events was, this timing is really incredible. He said, at our company, and this is a company of about 100 people, he said, we recognize that we don't really have a diverse workforce and that we're missing something because of that. And this is what really struck me. He said, we've begun to ask ourselves, what is it about the way we're going at this that's not working? So it's that, to me, is the kind of person that we're looking to draw, as well as the people who have doubts and have reactions about some of the conversations on racism. Come and talk about it. That's the whole idea. And I know Debbie is very open to having back and forth dialogue.
So we've got a lot to discuss with Debbie. The two events that Frank is talking about, 2 weeks from today, Thursday, October 19th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at St. John Fisher College. The public presentation is Race, Responsibility, and Leadership. A White Leader Examines Her Blind Spots. That's open to the public. You can register for these at expandingevents.org, expandingevents.org. And then Friday, 2 weeks from tomorrow, October 20th, from 8:30 to noon at St. John Fisher College, it's a leadership and race workshop, the beliefs we hold and the decisions we make. And once again, I think there's a way to register. Frank, how can people register for that?
At expandingevents.org.
Okay, expandingevents.org. So those are a couple events. And then Sunday, the 22nd,
yes,
I believe, Reverend Joel Miller is here. He's an interim senior minister at First Unitarian Church. And Reverend, what's going on that Sunday?
Well, that's Sunday,
Debbie.
It's Sunday the 8th.
This Sunday.
Oh, my goodness. Look what I've done. Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank. Yeah.
Thanks, everyone. It's this Sunday.
This Sunday.
Okay, Reverend, this Sunday the 8th, what's going on?
Debbie is coming the 8th to First Unitarian. We're welcoming anybody in the community to come to that. It's a community event. And she is coming to talk about her experience. And that is the great power in her book is how she relates her personal experience of coming to understand the role that racism played in as she grew up. Her book is a powerful experience for us, and we're bringing her here because we found in the past that we had tried to think our way, to reason our way through racism in order to solve it, to solve the problem with it, and that's not been good enough. We have found, especially through Debbie's book, that we have had there are emotional responses and spiritual responses we have when we encounter racism, and that is as important or more important than just trying to put policy into place to get rid of racism, that it's really a very personal experience. So you mentioned some listeners who are reluctant to listen to a show on racism. And they feel shamed, you know, like, why should I apologize for being white, for having grown up white? Or does whiteness even exist? They raise those questions. And for us at First Unitarian Church, the goal is not for anyone to need to apologize for who they are or to feel shame for who they are, but to understand that we all live our lives, and in the living of our lives, we have an effect on others. That effect can be positive, that effect can be negative. Our lives, and so with my congregation, for example, as we live our lives and have the benefits of growing up with the advantages, say, of living in a suburb like I grew up in, access to good education, the ability to walk down just about any street, say, in Rochester, and know that when a police car drives by, that's a good thing for us. That's not the same experience that a black member of my congregation is going to have necessarily. A black member of the congregation may be in Rochester and struggle to find quality education for their children or even have the time to nurture their children's education and their children. And in addition to that, always have the stress of when they get pulled over by a police officer while driving, what's that going to mean? Are they going to go to jail that day? Life is so much more difficult just because one is black or a person of color, as opposed to being a white person, like myself, for example.
So it's not about guilt. It's about recognizing difference.
Yes.
Okay.
That much. And that's what makes it a spiritual journey. And again, that's part of the power in Debbie's book, is that it's an emotional journey and it's a spiritual journey. Not about feeling guilt, not about feeling shame for who we are, and indeed being proud of the good things that are part of our upbringing and of the culture in which we live, but understanding that also there's these other diversities, other ways of being. And part of the experience of being white, especially, is not seeing these experiences of other folks, specifically of black folks or people of color. We think that if we just think our way through this, that we can then have equitable, good experiences.
Oh, Debbie's going to talk about that. Yeah, that is a big theme that Debbie has hit on. So Sunday, what time on Sunday, by the way?
7 o'clock.
7 p.m.?
Yes.
And where is it?
220 Winton Road South.
The First Unitarian?
First Unitarian Church.
And you said, by the way, Reverend, that it's open to the public. That's sort of the whole motto of First Unitarian. It's always open. It's one of the most open places in Rochester.
Yeah,
that's 7 p.m. this Sunday. Thank you for the correction. The 8th. And Debbie Irving is on the line with us, and she's the author of Waking Up White. And Debbie, you know, I open the hour just kind of going back to your childhood. I think so many listeners, particularly middle, upper class, white listeners, will relate to a lot of your childhood. Why don't you set the scene a little bit for us? And then if you could briefly take us to 2009 when the switch flipped, and then I've got plenty I want to work through in the book with you if you could, but why don't you take us back to your childhood?
Yeah. So I was born in 1960. You know, era always matters when we're in these conversations. So I was raised in the 1960s and 70s, Winchester, Massachusetts, an affluent suburb north of Boston, the youngest of five kids. Dad was a lawyer, took the train into Boston every day. My mom was a homemaker. So, you know, when I saw the movie or the TV show like Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet, that all felt like that was my family. And I did. I had a pretty rosy childhood and then went off to Kenyon College. Also, I call Winchester a white bubble. Kenyon College was also a white bubble, which, of course, I wouldn't have referred to it that way at the time. I just thought I was having a regular American life. And after college, I ended up working in performing arts on the management end of it. And found myself in quote-unquote inner-city neighborhoods. I now understand that's code for black, brown neighborhoods, because there was a lot of money being given away by foundations and corporations to somehow do something remedial in these neighborhoods that seemed to be, we called them under-resourced neighborhoods at the time. And so I was helping to raise money to bring after-school programs into these neighborhoods. And as I encountered neighborhoods, I obviously couldn't help but notice how different these neighborhoods looked in terms of how houses were kept up. Schools had windows broken in them. I mean, just the material presentation alone was so starkly different. And there was very definitely a correlation when I would see wealthier neighborhoods or middle-class neighborhoods, they seemed to be predominantly white, and when I saw impoverished neighborhoods, they seemed to be disproportionately black and brown. Yet I'd been taught that talking about race was rude. I'd been taught that talking about politics and religion was rude. And so you can't begin to understand race and racism if you don't talk about it, about politics and religion, because they're foundational to its very construction. So I was operating on the surface level, thinking that it was all racism was all about, do you like or are you nice to people of color as a white person? And so at that superficial level, I engaged in trying to, quote-unquote, help and getting, you know, not very far and feeling like my quote-unquote, help wasn't very welcome. And that perplexed me because I am a person of action. And usually when I set out to do something, I get it done, and I wasn't getting traction there. And I, like Frank said about so many business leaders, I had that running through my head. I'm missing something. What am I missing? Once I started a family, which was, 15 years into that 25-year stretch of being on diversity committees, working in Cambridge and Boston, started a family, I left the nonprofit world and became an elementary school teacher. Same thing happened. I knew I was missing something. I was in diverse classrooms, racially, ethnically, religiously diverse, and there was something I was missing. Finally, 2009, I go to get my master's in special ed. There's a required first course. It's called Racial and Cultural Identities. And I can't wait to go learn about black and brown children so I can help them better. lo and behold, I find out in the first class that each and every one of the students in this class, myself included, we're going to be doing a deep dive into our own racial and cultural identity. And my thought was, what am I going to be studying? Because I didn't even know at the age of 48 in 2009 that I had a racial and cultural identity or history worth studying. So at the end of 6 months, my entire belief system had been challenged. And that was the beginning. I mean, some people, I think, wow, she woke up. No, that was the beginning of the dissonance creating. That was when I really realized, oh, wow, there's a lot I don't know. No wonder I've been so confused. And that set me on a journey. Waking Up White is the chronicling of that journey.
Let me say to listeners, one of the reasons I think you will find this book so relatable is in the short chapters, Debbie relates her personal stories that track so closely to what so many families go through, and with good intention. This is not a book to shame people, I think, to what Frank and I were talking about earlier. It's a book that kind of peels back what seems either innocuous or basic or just sort of the common protocol of often suburban life. And then you start to see, with a little more analysis, some of the impact or some of the roots of it. I'm just going to go right to the start here, Debbie. You hit with a hammer right off the top, and you said that when you were 5 years old, you asked your mother, whatever happened to all the Indians? Common question, right? I mean, you know, you were five, and you were thinking, well, I don't see Native Americans, you know, not the way that they're presented. And if I could, I'm just going to quote this because it's amazing. Your mother said, quote, they drank too much. They were lovely people who became dangerous when they drank liquor. Dangerous from drinking, I asked my mother. Yes, it's so sad. They just couldn't handle it, and it ruined them, really, end quote. What an amazingly sort of sad thing. And I know you're relating some tough stuff about your family, but you also wanted to do it to be honest. I want you to tell me a little bit more, not only about that moment, but how that moment started to kind of set in you this view that, well, you know, white people drink liquor and we're fine, so maybe we're superior, even if you don't articulate that out loud. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, that moment is such a powerful moment. And when I do workshops and presentations, I discover that almost everybody has a moment they can go back to in their childhood where something massive got taught in a matter of seconds. So one of the first things I learned was it's scary to ask questions because you might get an answer that's really scary. And I noticed how uncomfortable my mother was in that moment. So children are naturally curious. I mean, who doesn't know a curious child? And so I was asking a curious question, and I got an answer that was so scary for me, and I watched my mother become uncomfortable that's how I learned not to talk about race. That's how I learned race was a scary topic. That's how I learned, ooh, this is something I feel like really yucky about. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you mentioned it, you know, it did start me down the path of this biological difference. So for anyone listening who still thinks that race is rooted in biology, it is not. Our ethnicity, we do have biological differences around our ethnicity, you know, the countries of origin that we come from. But race is a very clunky construct. It's in the United States, that's the only place this construct exists, and it's a legal construct, trying to group people into big categories. And really, as you'll learn if you come to see my presentation, so that resources could be distributed differentially along racial lines. So I start to buy into this idea that there's some kind of natural order, and white people seem to be on top. White people seem to be more superior, you know, better educated, more able to save money, smarter, harder working. And this is coming to me both in little snippets of language I hear and definitely if I look around me at the optics, as I mentioned before, I'm seeing white people disproportionately thriving and black and brown people disproportionately appearing to struggle. And how am I supposed to interpret that in a huge information vacuum because we're not supposed to talk about it? And so it's just that small little moment where I learned Curiosity can be a scary thing. There might be some kind of biological difference. And then the very specific thing about Indians being, you know, savage and dangerous and drunks. And that gets reaffirmed through cartoons and Westerns and other imagery I see about indigenous people, and the utter lack of representation I see about indigenous people in their own voices in my textbooks or in movies. So it's a very lopsided history told by white people about indigenous people that leaves me so ignorant. I don't even know what I don't know.
And for your own experience, not just as that five-year-old, but also growing up, you've said in public presentations, you can take that moment and you start to see how that embeds when society is teaching us two big concepts that reinforce this idea of, you know, maybe white people are just superior. You say two ideas that really developed in kind of a white bubble. Number one, America's playing field is level. Well, if it's level, how come when I look around, I see white people thriving and non-white people who are more often than white people struggling? And then there's a natural order, number two, that by nature, some people are more capable, fit to lead. And well, just from my experience growing up, I look around and it's usually white men in power. So maybe white men are superior. And it's powerful. It's really, really powerful. I wonder how these kind of presentations land with people who maybe haven't been as direct in thinking about that as you have, Debbie.
Well, that's the challenge. You know, everything I do, I create tools. I see myself as a tool maker. The book is a tool. My presentations are tools. Every time I'm thinking about how to design and deliver a tool, I'm trying to get to me. I'm thinking about how would I have received this pre-wake-up? Because why did it take me till age 48? I believe there are more white people out there who would want to know how things work and how we've been misled than there are people who want to fold their arms and say, I like it this way and I don't want to change it. And so I'm always trying to create tools that will be received. And as an educator, you know, this is the everything you ever learned in life you learned in kindergarten. Well, I learned that as a teacher. One of the most important things educators do is we meet people where they are. So, for instance, you're not going to start teaching geometry to somebody who hasn't learned addition and subtraction. So all of my stuff is really meant to be a 101 for white people. So, and I'm never encouraging guilt or shame, though that can be inevitable. I think most people walk away from my presentation saying, how did I not know this? How is this possible? And there might be some guilt, some shame, but most often there's this sense of, I've been duped, and I don't want that anymore. I want to get educated.
Can I also say, Debbie, that I will admit that I was surprised. I found myself surprised by the end of your book, finding myself saying, you know, part of the book that I thought was going to be a little lecturing, I ended up really appreciating, which is this. At the end of every chapter, you have a question or several questions related to the material. And at first, it kind of felt like a workbook or kind of a workshop. But I have to tell you, from that first chapter on what your mother said about Native Americans, where the question at the end of that chapter is, what stereotypes about people of another race do you remember hearing and believing as a child? I can name those. I can name those. That, and I bet you everyone listening can. And that is tough, but it's powerful. And so at the end of every chapter, there are questions related to this. And I actually found myself really appreciating that and getting over my initial, oh, is she going to do this workshop thing? Because I thought it was really powerful. And it was a way, if you actually do it, take those questions and maybe write something down, that it can move people and change people. Have you heard from readers who've actually kind of gone through the book and done all of that, Debbie, and found themselves impacted?
Oh, every day I hear from readers. I get emails, people come up to me at talks. Every day I have people saying, wow, I had no idea. Here's my absolute favorite. A couple months ago, a couple came up to me, and they had recently celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary. And they had one copy of the book. They had shared it. They had read it together, and they had done the questions. And they took a couple days to do one chapter and talk about the question at the end. And they said, we learned things about each other we had never known in 50 years. We know each other better thanks to your book.
Yeah.
That's my favorite.
But there are also moments in the book where some readers, especially more skeptical readers, might say, come on, is this a bridge too far? And I want to address some of that. First of all, fascinating moment from your chapter in which you described going to a national conference on privilege, on white privilege, in which you said it was 1,500 people at the conference, about 85% white. And here's an interaction that I want to touch on and get your take on this, because you write in this book, and especially in this chapter, about how you have had moments where you've been sort of confronted that what you were doing made someone uncomfortable or was a little bit tone deaf or clumsy, and that those moments you try to internalize and understand. Well, here was this conference, and you end up having lunch, and you sit down, and in one of your table mates, you had a chance to talk to a man named Henry, and I believe, if I remember correctly, Henry was an African-American? Okay, a person of color, and so let me just read from the book here. Oh, here we are. So you said you wanted to break the ice. So Henry, what do you do for work in Chicago? The conversation went on from there. We chatted with Henry and the assortment of other people who eventually filled our table. I thought it had been a lunch without incident. As we walked away, Barbara said to me, do you remember how you asked Henry right off the bat what he did for work? Uh-oh, I thought. Yes, I said. Well, that's one of those things I've learned can drive people of color crazy. I felt dumbstruck. Not only had I never heard this, but I couldn't imagine how that could possibly be offensive. It was a standard first question at a professional conference, isn't it? What? I stopped in my tracks. Why? I know. Barbara put her hand on my arm and shook her head. I know. This is why it's so tricky. It's the first question you ask in a white setting, right? What do you do for a living? Yes. And I pictured my own father, my uncles, and my white coworkers greeting each other with a hearty handshake and a, so what do you do, Tim? If there were a top 10 list of icebreaker questions in my world, this would be on it. Well, Barbara explained, for people of color, it can easily be felt as you questioning someone's credentials. And frankly, most cultures around the world don't rank what you do for work as a hot topic of conversation. The glorification of professional status is a white culture thing. All right, Debbie, so there's that interaction. And some of our readers might say, are you being overly self-critical to feel badly about that? That's just normal, asking people what they do for a living. Or did you really take what Barbara said, and did you think, well, I've only been seeing this from sort of a white perspective? I mean, tell me a little bit more about how you felt about that.
Well, my first reaction was to be really pissed off at Barbara. Like, Jesus, you're watching me like a hawk. How dare you? And who cares about that? That's so minor. I have learned that when I hear these words emerge from my own mind, it's a red flag. Here are the words. That's ridiculous. To this day, when I hear someone tell me something and I hear my mind say, that's ridiculous, I now know to say, whoops, someone's challenging your belief system and you have a choice here. You can judge the person who just told you and judge the idea, or you can consider it long enough to take it in. Maybe it's true. It requires suspending your own it requires that I suspend my own reality long enough to at least consider what someone is saying. So that's a real skill that I'm still developing, however many years later, 9 years later. It's getting easier. But in that moment, I just wanted to, soccer. I was like, I just had a nice lunch. I'm having a good time here. Like, why would you point that out? And how do you even know? I can tell you now, I'm 100% sure that's a real thing. So there's this whole body of work called microaggressions, which is about seemingly small to white people moments like that, where white people will do something that's absolutely normalized in white spaces that's just so annoying and or seriously hurtful in racially mixed spaces. So let me do this to explain what a microaggression is. Imagine that you're a young couple and you're trying so hard. You want to get pregnant, but you're suffering terribly from infertility. You don't share this with everyone. This is a really painful thing that you as a young couple are experiencing. Yet when you go into social settings, people are like, when's that baby coming along? Or maybe it's a person who is heterosexual and they haven't come out. They don't plan to come out and share it with everybody, but every time they're in a social setting, so have you met that special lady yet? Have you met that special man? So these are all typical questions. The first, normalizing having a baby without incident, and the second, normalizing heterosexuality. So there are things that are built into our ways of being socially that assume that kind of conversation isn't going to have a negative impact, but it can. So on the racial front, there's a whole host of things that people say, and I hear them all over the country, all across ages, and that what do you do for work is so annoying, or where are you from? So there's this perception from, not perception, there's an experience in people of color communities that white people can only relate to you once they can get you in a box. I need to know what you do for work in order to relate to you. I need to know where you're from, Asian-looking person, before I know how to relate to you. And the challenge from people of color to white people is, can you find something less superficial to talk about? Can we talk about something that's going to be more about our humanity than about the labels that get slapped on us all the time? And hey, white people, how often do you go up to another white person and say, hey, where are you from? No, I mean, where are you from? Meaning, are you German? What's your ancestry? And how often, and we do go up to white people, I know, as a white person, and say, what do you do for work? But I have stopped doing that because the conversations that you have, if you don't go to that place, if you go to a deeper place, are amazing.
Listeners, before the hour began, I just jumped on Twitter just out of curiosity, and I posed a question. I said, a question for white followers, what's a quick example of white advantage that has impacted your life? I just want to say our listeners are coming through with a barrage of stories, very self-aware stories now in their adulthood. And if you want to read that, just jump on my Twitter feed and take a look at some of the responses there. Very direct about the advantages that they have recognized. And that's just off the top of their head. That's not sitting down and really thinking, how did I get into college? Did somebody help me? Happened to me, by the way. I got waitlisted at the school I wanted to go into, and I had a parent who knew someone on the board of trustees, two white men. That was my life. It's probably the reason I'm sitting here with this microphone. So so the book has so much of that, asking us to identify that, but and I can't get to all of the themes, but listeners, the book is called Waking Up White. Debbie Irving is going to be here for a number of events coming up 2 weeks from now, but also on this Sunday night at 7 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church. For an event, and Reverend Joel Miller is here. Frank Starpoli is a leadership coach and organizer of Expanding Events, and you go to expandingevents.org for the events that are coming up on Thursday, October 19th, Friday, October 20th, if you want to get involved in that. I've got to get our only break of the hour in, and what I want to do is go to some of the listener questions that have come in by email, or listeners, if you want to call the program, and weigh in with your own thoughts about what you're hearing here. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We will work through some of your questions next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about the water we use and what causes water pollution. Now, maybe you think in our community it's not a big deal, or you think we're fortunate, we've had plenty of rain, and we're not like communities that we see in the South dealing with hurricanes, but we have plenty of issues related to water quality and questions about what we do in our own lives. What are our habits? How much water we use during showers, or whether we fertilize our lawns? That's all next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Don writes to the program and says, white Americans are on track to be a minority in this country in about 25 years. How do you think that will affect racism and race relations? Debbie?
Well, it's interesting when we think about numbers. We are definitely headed, I think, 2043 is the number, is that magical moment where we're going to shift from white majority to white minority. But consider this. If we're talking about diversity, plantations were diverse. So in that situation, the majority were, enslaved Africans, and the minority were white people. So it isn't always about who's populating the space. It has a lot to do with who's holding the power. And the power is the power to control who has access to rights, who has access to resources, who has access to the narrative, who's telling the story about who we are as an organization or a nation, and who, And stereotypes are the dominant group telling stories about who other people are. So there's that. You know, the question is, will the power be differentially or distributed differently than it has been historically in the United States? We say it's a land of freedom for all, but in fact, James Madison, our fourth president, and also known as the father of the Constitution, is on record as having said that the point of government is to protect the minority of the opulent from the majority. And so we have built into all of our systems and structures mechanisms that protect the elite. And the elite are disproportionately white, male, Christian, heterosexual, or presenting heterosexual, able-bodied, and did I say Christian? So I think that the power structure, if left unchallenged, we will still have a class strata. And I think that racially it won't look much different.
Mm-hmm. And Don, by the way, follows up to say other countries with white minorities like Brazil tend to see them retreat into their own communities, and why would America be any different?
Yeah, and I don't know much about Brazil. That's interesting. It would be really interesting to do a study of how other societies and countries around the world are responding as we become more global and populations and demographics are shifting. I will say that what I see as the number one changer is that we do have a generation coming up that is much more racially mixed in terms of who's at college together, who's at university together. And that population right now that has been in college maybe for the last 8 to 10 years and is in right now and will be entering, those people are really going head-to-head right now with how the racial divide is showing up on campuses. We're seeing it in campuses all over the country. And I think that because the black and brown people often know the history, they can't buy into the white myths that are perpetuated by the dominant white group in the United States, because those myths, they know that that's not true. So a lot of that mythology is getting challenged and broken down in classrooms and on campuses right now. And so I think that the myth challenging, the exposing of lies through history in the United States, is what's going to be the game changer. And I think right now we're in a Civil Rights II moment. If Civil Rights I was about laws, I'm thinking about the moment we're in right now is about lies, is having, you know, the Band-Aid pulled off, so that everyone can see the degree to which there's been a lot of misleading going on about the history here.
And Debbie, you also say that you think there's a couple of phrases that get either misused or misapplied, and those are celebrating diversity and tolerance. Tell us why those words and phrases come up, and maybe you cringe when others think that they're trying to promote something positive.
And those are, by the way, I used those words in my 25 years on diversity committees when I didn't know what I was doing. Yeah, so celebrating diversity goes really well with a colorblind mindset. It's so great we're all different. Let's celebrate our differences. And this is often, we'll see it in schools and what I call food, flags, and festivals, where we're really operating at a very surface level, and we're talking about superficial differences. We're not talking about the system into which everyone alive in the United States today was either born or has moved here and has to navigate. And so it's to try to be create programs that are about diversity and inclusion without looking at the system that we are living in, it's sort of like trying to rearrange deck chairs on the Titanic. The word tolerance, you know, I definitely thought that my job as a white person was to tolerate people of color coming into organizations that I was a part of. And when I started to think about it, I was like, yuck. Like, if someone told me they were tolerating me, what an insult. I'm, you know what, Evan? I can really tolerate you these days. You know?
Yes.
So the spin I've taken on the word tolerate is really the tolerance. My job around tolerance is to learn to tolerate my own discomfort. So for people, you know, who are out there saying, this is a really, really challenging conversation I'm listening to on the radio, or this woman's trying to make me feel guilty and ashamed, I would say, wow, are there some feelings that you might need to try tolerating? can you challenge yourself to tolerate your emotions differently? And in my own work, to tolerate, like that moment that Barbara pulled me aside and said, "Did you know what you just said was, you know, potentially offensive?" What I've had to do is I've had to grow my own emotional capacity to be challenged by other people, to hear different points of view that don't jive with my own, that might not show me or my family up in a good light anymore. And that emotional capacity that I've grown, just to, you know, give people a self-centered incentive to get into this work, I am such a stronger, more resilient, better person in all parts of my life. I'm a better mother. I'm a better wife. I'm a better sister. I'm a better friend. And I'm a better facilitator. I'm better at being a learner. So I can't say enough. It's really, you know, it's waking up white, and it's becoming a human being again. Because we're all born with a lot of human qualities, but I feel like I really had to shut mine down and dumb mine down to go along with the system that I was born into. And, yeah, I'm finally growing up.
Reverend, you want to jump in there?
I do. You know, I'm listening to Debbie, and I'm realizing that in the history of my particular denomination, that we once spoke of tolerance and how important that was. But what that left us was very shallow experiences with one another. We never truly talked about the depths of our own lives. And it's this, as Debbie's describing, being tolerant of our own discomfort, the sense of shame that might arise and realizing, oh my gosh, I started by asking, what do you do, and not even knowing. And then being able to move on to the anger we experienced when we see the difficulties that a new friend has experienced for years, the sense of sadness that we allowed that to go on so long. Tolerating these feelings allows us to find a depth in our own lives that is, it's a wondrous, joyful place. It's something I want for the people in my congregation. So this isn't ultimately not just about race, although it has to be about race. It's ultimately about all of the lives of both the people in my congregation and the people in Rochester being deeper, richer, fuller, more beautifully woven together. And that's what Debbie's book does. That's where it leads us.
We have a couple of emails from listeners who are responding to the discussion about Debbie's interaction with the gentleman at the conference, in which she said, you know, what do you do for a living and how that may land with people of color. So James writes and says, "Hi, Evan. I would add that the way we initially approach others who differ from us, particularly in terms of seemingly harmless questions we may pose, not only communicates a desire to determine how we might relate to them, but whether or not we approve of them." That's from James. CJ writes to the program and says, "Wow, that discussion of, so what do you do, really helped me understand why saying so articulate can be hurtful. I would say that of any young person who speaks well, but I had not seen it as a judgment rather than a compliment." So he has a question for you, Debbie. He says, "What do you say now to break the ice in conversation?"
I often will try to say something about that where we are. So at a conference, for instance, I would say, how's your morning gone? How's your morning gone? Just an open question. And then I might say, what did you end up going to? And, you know, we'll compare notes about the workshops we went to. If we're at a concert, if I bump into somebody at a concert who I don't know, again, this is very different. Like, once you have a relationship with someone, all this goes away. But as in these icebreaker questions. But say I'm at a concert with someone, I'll say, I'll ask a question about the concert. So I try to, instead of asking these kind of personal, invasive, labely, judgy questions, which I can now see that they are, I try to speak experience.
And that's, by the way, that's tough. And that chapter, if I recall correctly, challenges the reader to think of the number of questions you can ask that don't pertain to where someone is from or what they do for a living when you meet them, to kind of break the ice. And so it puts a question on us. And if it's hard for us to come up with that, which it is, it probably says a lot about that.
And Evan, we can practice it in white spaces. You don't have to wait to be with a person. If you're a white person, you don't have to wait to be with a person of color. Start changing the way you interact in your white spaces.
Well, let me just say again, I asked listeners on Twitter, you know, what's a quick example of white advantage that has impacted your life? And there are so many interesting comments here. I'm just going to read a few. Caleb says, once I was pulled over at about 2 a.m., I reached into my glove compartment to get the driver's license and registration, and a Ziploc full of prescription drugs, legitimate prescription drugs, fell out. It didn't look good at all. However, my explanation was accepted without any further scrutiny. Sarah says, strangers never tell me how to parent my kids, in contrast to my friends raising black children. Adam says, he's a college professor. Student evaluations that form part of my performance package are clearly biased toward white males. And he adds, by the way, my brother was arrested twice for misdemeanor drug charges. He got community service, and they were expunged from his record. Tony says, in high school, the police just took my weed and let me go. So the list goes on here. I could probably read for 20 minutes of people who are writing in, and I admire them for just in a public forum like this on social media saying, yep, that's me, just as I tried to do a little earlier. I mean, we're having a conversation about what advantage means, what privileges, and what identity, you know, what advantages are sort of baked into our society and what that means to us. The author of the book Waking Up White, Debbie Irving, is our guest. Frank Starpoli, remind our listeners, 2 weeks from today, Debbie will be here for events on Thursday and Friday of that week. What do you want them to know?
I would say for those events that our particular focus, and we've asked Debbie to nuance what she's doing toward this, is leadership, how to lead organizations. At the same time, the Thursday night event on October 19th is open to the public, and so people who are not able to make it to First Unitarian this Sunday would be able to come to that event. The Friday morning, October 20th workshop is specifically for business leaders, and that, I think, is close to selling out already. So I had flashbacks, Debbie, as you were talking about microaggressions, to the client I mentioned before who has asked himself the question, his organization is asking, what is it about the way we're going at things? That's exactly, I think, what some business leaders are looking to understand is, what is it that I don't see here? What is it that I'm missing? What do I need to learn? And I think it takes a certain amount of both courage and humility to dive into these topics, and it's necessary.
Let me also ask Reverend Miller what you want people to know about Sunday night.
Sunday is a great opportunity for anybody in the community of any faith to come and hear from Debbie about the personal experience of encountering what it means to be white. I'm sure that's something that a lot of folks of color already know because they have to deal with it every day. But for those of us who are kind of like fish in water, not aware of the water, this is a great opportunity to see things we learned not to see. And in the experience of waking up to others' lives, wake up more fully to our own lives.
And Debbie, we're down to about our last minute or so here. I'd ask you to leave our listeners with another idea for action. And you do that in the book and you do that in your presentations, and our listeners may be hearing this and thinking, okay, if I'm going to recognize this in my life, what's another method of change? What would you leave them with?
Well, because so often people, white people, will say, tell me what to do, two colleagues and I have developed what we call the 21-day racial equity challenge, or the racial justice challenge. It lives on my website. It's Debbie. Irving.com, so Debbie's with a Y, Irving's with an I, and you're going to look for the 21-day plan. And so neuroscience tells us that it takes 21 days to create a new habit. A lot of this is very habitual, such as the what do you do for work thing, or what media are we listening to? So the 21-day plan is full of resources, and we challenge people to do one small thing every single day that starts to program your neural pathways differently so that you start to become more curious. You start to have new connections in your life, new conversations, new media sources. So that's the quickest thing I can do, and it's a really powerful plan. Entire cities have done it. Entire campuses have done it. So Rochester, 21-day plan. There's your challenge. Mm-hmm.
Debbie Irving is the author of the book Waking Up White, which you can get now, and you can meet her Sunday night at the First Unitarian Church. Reverend Joel Miller from First Unitarian, thank you for spending the hour with us. Great having you here.
It's good to be here.
And go to the website expandingevents.org for a couple of events starting 2 weeks from today, Thursday the 19th, and then Friday, October 20th, with Debbie Irving. Frank Starpoli, leadership coach and the organizer of Expanding Events, thank you for being here, Frank.
Thank you, Evan.
And Debbie, I appreciate the conversation and the book, and we look forward to seeing you in Rochester. Thank you so much for the time.
Thanks. I appreciate all of you.
All right.
See you soon.
You got it. We'll take a short break. Much more Connections next.